And this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and the time now is 1.5 minutes after 4 o'clock. Well, during the next hour, we're going to hear Noel Coward singing one of his own songs, we'll hear early Marlene Dietrich recordings, and some early recordings of her good friend Greta Keller, and George Burns will sing, and more. These are all recordings from the catalog of a small record company called Stanion Records. The owner of Stanion Records is in the studio with me now. I think you'll recognize his name. It's Rod McEwen. People tend to have strong feelings about Rod McEwen. His admirers have bought over 16 million copies of his books, but many other people find his sentimentality insufferable. Rod McEwen has written many books of poems, including a new one called Coming Close to the Earth. He's also written scores for television and film, including two which won him Academy Award nominations. He recently returned from the Soviet Union, where he worked on the score for a television documentary series called The Unknown War. Much of his time is spent on concert tours, and he'll be performing in Philadelphia at the Walnut Street Theater New Year's Eve. He's issued many albums of his own songs and singing and scores and orchestral works on Stanion Records. I first found out that he had a record company about 2 years ago. Ann Mintz was doing a random sampler here on Fresh Air and had played a record of Noel Coward singing his own songs. I loved it and asked to borrow it. When I got it home, as I listened to it, I was reading the liner notes on back and read there, produced by Rod McEwen. Well, I was very surprised. Before we meet Rod McEwen, let's listen to Noel Coward from one of his Stanion releases now, singing There Are Bad Times Just Around the Corner.
They're out of sorts in Sunderland and terribly cross in Kent. They're dull in Hull and the Isle of Mull is seething with discontent. They're nervous in Northumberland and Devon is down the drain. They're filled with wrath on the Firth, the Forth and sullen on Salisbury Plain. In Dublin they're depressed lads, maybe because they're Celts. For Drake is going west, lads, and so is everyone else. Hooray, 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 misery's on the way. There are bad times just around the corner. There are dark clouds hurtling through the sky, and it's no good whining about a silver lining, for we know from experience that they won't roll by. With a scowl and a frown, we'll keep our peckers down and prepare for depression and doom and dread. We're going to unpack our troubles from our old kit bag and wait until we drop down dead. There are bad times just around the corner. The horizon's gloomy as can be. There are blackbirds over the greyish cliffs of Dover, and the rats are preparing to leave the BBC. We're an unhappy breed and very bored indeed when reminded of something that Nelson said. And while the press and the politicians nag, 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 we'll wait until we drop down dead. From Colwyn Bay to Kettering, they're sobbing themselves to sleep. The shrieks and wails in the Yorkshire Dales have even depressed the sheep. In rather vulgar lettering, a very disgruntled group have posted bills on the Cotswold Hills to prove that we're in the soup. While begging Kipling's pardon, there's one thing we know for sure. If England is a garden, we ought to have more manure. Hooray, 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 suffering and dismay. There are bad times just around the corner, and the outlook's absolutely vile. There are home fires smoking from Windermere to Woking, and we're not going to tighten our belts and smile, smile, smile at the sound of a shot. We just as soon as not to take a hot water bottle and go to bed. We're going to untense our muscles till they sag, 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 and wait until we drop down dead. There are bad times just around the corner. We can all look forward to despair. It's as clear as crystal from Bridlington to Bristol that we can't save democracy and we don't much care. If the reds and the pinks believe that England stinks and that world revolution is bound to spread,
we'd better all learn the lyrics of the old red flag and wait until we drop down dead. A likely story, land of hope and glory. Wait until we drop down dead.
Noel Coward singing his own "There Are Bad Times Just Around the Corner." That was recorded in 1970. It appears on an album called Noel Coward Greatest Hits Volume 1. The album was produced by my guest in the studio, Rod McEwen. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have
you. Thank you.
It's
nice to be here, and I'm delighted to hear you play real records. I mean, in traveling around the country, listening to radio, whether it's AM or FM, even public radio, you get such a surfeit of what the latest hit is or what the urge of the moment is. That very seldom do I get the chance to not only hear records that I've been involved with or artists I've been involved with that may fall into the nostalgia category, the standard category, but records by so many artists that I think are great that I just wish I had produced or wish I had been involved with. And it's I think it's a very fortunate thing that, that you're on every day and people can sample this kind of material.
Well, thanks. You know what I think really surprised me at first, the first time I heard this record and listened to, like, "There Are Bad Times Just Around the Corner," and saw that you'd produced it. That the whole song and, like, the idea "There Are Bad Times Just Around the Corner" is really very contrary to the sensibility that I usually find in the things that you've written or that you've sung, which are usually about good times and beauty and finding wonderful things everywhere. And
you know what? You make
sarcastic.
You know, you're a there is something very typical in what you've said. It's a typical misunderstanding about a lot of things. There's a book of mine called "Listen to the Warm," which has sold something like, I don't know, it was about 3 million copies or something like that. A lot of books. Most people get as far as "A Cat Named Sloopy" or "Pushing the Clouds Away" or whatever, but they forget there are 12 poems in there that not only request social change, they demand it. There's one that says, "Let's not let our hair grow so long. It covers up our eyes and makes us unable to see," which has nothing to do with hair, but has to do with the fact that one mustn't adopt a lifestyle so early in life that they don't keep their eyes open to change, which is very important, and particularly in this country, which is a very fast-changing country, and which is what we really owe the goodness of the country to and the great things that the country's brought us. There is an absolute, there's such a diatribe on organized religion in it that the book was banned by many churches. There is a send-up of all folk singers in it. So that's the problem. I mean, I think it's a pity in a way. I mean, I like to sing quiet things and sad things, and people remember "Seasons in the Sun" and "If You Go Away" and "Gene" and "Love's Been Good to Me" and "Champion Charlie Brown," but they forget I wrote "The Complete Madam Butterfly" in a minute and a half, and "Everybody's Rich But Us," and about the Kennedy administration, "The Intellectual Rag," and "Methinks Thou Doth Protest Too Much," and "Don't Ban the Bomb."
So you don't really see any disparity, you know, between the irony expressed by Coward and
No, I mean, I think that Coward just happened to be a great writer, and I'm in love with great writers. I mean, in my lifetime, the two, aside from Coward, Coward is on a different plane, and Coward is British. But the two great American writers, the greatest ones were Johnny Mercer, because he had a warmth and a talent for touching people. He's the only writer I know, the only American writer I ever know, to have written a lyric that stands up on its own as a poem. Bob Dylan didn't. Bob Dylan wrote poems, and he wrote lyrics, and they were different. I've never done it. I mean, I've written lyrics, and I've written poems, too, but never "The Twain Shall Meet." And the other writer, of course, is Larry Hart. And he was capable of wit, urbanity, great sadness, great pathos. And yet the heroes and the heroines in his songs always survive. They always manage to get through. The song, by the way, I was speaking of before that stands on its own as a sheer piece of poetry is "Moon River." And with the addition of the Mancini music, it's an absolutely exquisite song, but it's also a great piece of poetry with a great piece of philosophy.
When did you first get together Stand In Records, and what was your concept and back of it when you did?
a frustration, really. It was before I went with RCA and sued to get away from them, went with Warner Brothers and sued to get away from them. I was frustrated at the way my own records were being distributed. They were selling in the millions, and they still do sell very well, but the point is, I didn't feel that they were reaching the audience that I was trying to reach. I wasn't trying to do something specialized. I was trying to make interesting and unusual music and recordings for all kinds of people, Republicans and Democrats and blacks and Jews and Presbyterians and one-armed paper hangers and whatever, for people. You know, and that's really been the criteria for the whole Stallion series. There are about 400 albums in the line now, and that have been released, and we have about 200 more albums that have not been released from all time periods, including very recent things. Some of the things that we're very proud of is the fact that we have the only complete showboat ever recorded. We went into business with EMI to do that. We did a double album, taking all the songs that have been written for the various versions of Showboat and putting them into one album. They did it. They opted to use just a single album, a solo album over there. They now import our double album in Great Britain and sell it very well. And, of course, that started Cleo Lane on a solo career here. And her solo album, Day by Day, was offered to every company in this country, and nobody took it. So we did, and she got a $100,000 a year contract from RCA as a result of it.
So you started Stallion because you were frustrated with your own recording right. deals with major record companies, but once begun, you started to acquire other people's music.
Yes, my theory was that the record business had given me a great deal, and I'd earned a lot of money from it, and I felt it was time to give it back. There were so many record companies that were founded on artists like Dietrich and Vera Lynn and Fats Waller and even as far back as Buck and Bubbles and people like Lena Horne, even Dinah Shore. And yet those companies, if somebody could come along now and play guitar and plunk a few chords on it, it doesn't matter whether they can even sing or not or carry a tune. They'd much rather record them because of the high volume in the record business than look into their vaults and find records. And there were also a lot of artists that had been passed by. When we started recording Chris Connor again, she had not had a nightclub date for years. And we got her going again, Sylvia Sims going again, Ellis Larkins, great pianist. Things are happening for him. We sold more Noel Coward records, I think, than anybody has ever sold.
You did an interesting thing with that, which I didn't know until you mentioned it before we went on the air. It was produced in 1970, the record.
Yes, that particular track on the album was, and several of the others, some in 69 as well. We used the old arrangements. We made no attempt at recording them in stereo. We tried to get as near the sound as the original recordings. The problem with the original recordings was that they were made on acetate, sometimes even on wire, and sometimes direct to disc, and the sound was just really not good enough, you know. And so we wanted to. Noel Coward was singing very well. There was no reason why he couldn't, you know, sing it. This was shortly before his death.
Well, the next thing we're going to listen to is from someone whose music Noel Coward really enjoyed, and that's Marlene Dietrich. And this is a different situation. This record, this is an old record.
Yes, it's compiled from all over the place. We worked very hard in Vienna and in Berlin reconstructing this album, and it never was an album, per se, and we made it into an album.
You found old 78s?
Yes, from different periods of time, and also air checks that were never released. And you've chosen, I think, what?
Falling in Love Again.
This is one of my favorite songs that she's ever sung, and I don't think she ever sings it badly, but this is a particularly good recording of it, I think.
Okay, let's hear Falling in Love Again from an album on Stallion Records sung by Marlene Dietrich. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Rod McEwen.
I often stop and wonder why I appeal to men. How many times I blunder in love and love again. They offer me devotion. I like it, I confess. When I reflect emotion, there's no need to guess. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it. Love's always been my game, play it how I may. I was made that way, I can't help it. Men cluster to me like moths around the flame, and if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
That was Marlene Dietrich, and as you may have suspected, what we heard was from the soundtrack of the movie.
It was from the augmented soundtrack. The original film was done in German, and then the film was quite successful in this country, undubbed, done with subtitles. So they decided to dub the film, and it was not as successful as the one with the subtitles.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rod McEwen, and the music that we're listening to is records that are on the Stanion record label, the record label that he directs. And we're going to next be listening to someone who is a friend of Marlene Dietrich, someone who you've worked with as well. And her name is Greta Keller, and I frankly was not at all familiar with her till.
You know, it's very sad about Greta Keller. She died last year. She was in her 80s. And Wade Alexander, who is president of Stanion Records, he and I were both very, very close to Greta. And I must say, the records on the label really reflect our tastes. I mean, things that we like and things that we feel should not go unnoticed. For instance, we do some classical things. We have an album called The Definitive Planets. It's the only album available that was ever it was never released. It was recorded but never released of Gustav Holst conducting the planets himself. And we pieced that together, and then we have on the back of it on another record, it takes two records, Sir Malcolm Sargent conducting the London Philharmonic in a stereo version of it. And then also we have a recording of Pictures and Exhibition with John Pritchard and the Royal Philharmonic on one side, and the other side is a jazz version that was done in the 50s by Ralph Burns. So it's very important to us to try to rescue some of these things that go by the wayside. Once in a while you'll make a deal with a record company, and just for a flat fee, or you'll lease them and you'll pay the money. But we always try to pay the artists as well. We try to track down the artists and pay them. And, of course, people like Noel and Greta and Marlene, they one of the things, in fact, we pride ourselves on is that most people can recognize our records by the first names of the artist. Fats, Vera, Noel, Greta.
How did you meet Marlene Dietrich?
I met Marlene Dietrich. She came to see a concert of mine once, and she was quoted as saying I was the only man singing in America. And I thought, my God, I've got to meet this woman. And I did meet her, and as everybody who meets her does, I immediately fell, you know, under her very considerable charm. And we've had a lasting friendship. It's gone on for some years now. And I saw her recently in Paris. She's been working on her memoirs, working at them. It's coming slow for her. But she's a great, great woman. And she's the kind of human being that she'll look at you and say, you're skinny. And then she'll go in and here is this exotic creature you've seen all these years and you've heard so many things about. And she'll suddenly make you a 5 or 6 course meal. Like a house frog, just sit there and make you eat it.
How did she react to your interest in, you know, reissuing old recordings of hers? Is, you know, does she still feel connected with them?
She feels very detached about them. It took a lot of persuasion to, when I told her that I was acquiring the masters, she said, oh, don't do that. I said, of course. I said, you know, they belong to the world and they haven't been heard from for a long time. She said, oh, but I sing so much better now. And I said, well, you sing differently now, not necessarily better. And it took a lot of persuasion. She's quite an extraordinary woman, as was Greta Keller. Greta Keller, even as late as just before her death last year, she was still playing nightclubs in San Francisco and New York and Vienna every year. She would do her birthday concert in Vienna, and I did mine in New York City, and she introduced me to Vienna. She took me to the Brahms Hall, which is where Brahms actually played, you know, and where they have guards standing over the spotlights because they're carbon and they're so afraid that a spark might ignite the hall. So you have to pay for armed guards to stand there while you're performing. And it was funny because we had Bankar and Hilda Guden and people like that in the audience for me. And when I came on stage wearing blue jeans and sneakers, for the second half of the concert, because Greta had done the first half, there was such an audible intake of air that we had to open the windows practically. It was really a very unusual experience. But I'm not necessarily a nostalgia freak. I just happen to think that there has been a great deal of good music down through the ages, including right now. I was just at an interview in a newspaper today, and we were talking about, I was saying that the fact that I'm going to be performing here New Year's Eve, I'm starting a whole new tour. You know, I've been appearing in front of big audiences. I played for 250,000 people in Paris a couple of weeks ago, and this will be for a few hundred people each show on New Year's Eve. And it's a thing where I'm going to do all different kinds of things, including a tribute to American composers. And I was saying that two of my favorite two of my favorite albums in the last 10 years have been the first solo albums that Paul Simon made and the first solo album that Art Garfunkel made. And one of the songs that I think is absolutely, after you can say this on public radio because cows do defecate, after all the bullshit that you go through on a bicentennial and things like that, to hear a song like An American Tune that Paul Simon wrote, we come on the ship, the Mayflower, we sail on the ship to the moon, you know. So a great positive thing to say about America. So I hope to be doing some of those things too. So I'm not really stuck back in the 1930s in any way, but it's just that there is so much music. And I happen to have liked records all my life and own a very large record collection, more than 500,000 LPs, one room devoted to nothing but records.
Really?
And I just know where a lot of bodies are buried. Try to dig them up now and then.
Well, we're going to give a listen to a selection from an album called Great Songs of the 30s with Greta Keller, who was a friend of Marlene Dietrich's, who, as you were mentioning, you knew well and How did she react? You told us how Marlene Dietrich reacted to
she
you.
She loved it. She's a ham. She was always totally a ham, and she liked her records from any period, and she had good reason to, because she was a great, great singer.
Okay, well, we're going to hear a selection which is called The New Step. Greta Keller has recorded in 1930 a tune called The New Step. It's featured on a Stanion record called Greta Keller, Great Songs of the 30s. My guest in the studio is the head of Stanion Records, Rod McEwen, who I'm sure you also know through his books and his poetry. A new book of his has been published called Coming Close to the Earth, published by Simon & Schuster. What happens when find old 78s like you've done for this record and reissue them? What kind of money, if any, does the artist whose 78s you've recorded see from it?
We try to pay the artist because they usually never were paid in the first place. As I mentioned to you before, the Andrews sisters got paid $40 a piece for Chattanooga Choo Choo, and Decca Records made about $20 million over the years off of that. Just Decca alone, which is now MCA. Now, that's a lot of that's a lot of money, and that's, you're talking about when records were priced at almost nothing, you know, and so ever since the World War II, that record has been a standard, as has Beer Barrel Polka by them. So with that thought in mind, even when we record new artists, or we make rather new recordings for the company, as in the case of Sylvia Sims and Chris Connor and some of the new things that we've done, I don't know, with people like Jerry Southern, we don't sign them to contracts. We didn't even sign Cleo Lane to a contract. We'd rather they have the exposure, and we're not equipped really to service the artist and sell their records in stores the way a Columbia or an RCA might be. And we're thrilled if somebody picks them up. For instance, A&M picked up Sylvia Sims, and she's doing very well for them. She's got a new album coming out where she salutes Fred Astaire. And we're tickled pink about that because to us it means that maybe these people's careers have had a chance to go on because of the fact that we wanted to reissue the records. Once in a while you lose your shirt on an album, but it doesn't matter. Maybe you make it up on the others. I mean, Stallion Records is not the most successful record company in the world as far as making money goes, but we're an honest record company, and we're one that cares about our product, and we try to get the noise out of the 78s as much as we can, if that's what we're reissuing, but never at the cost of taking away the highs and lows of the artist.
There's some real big differences between some of the records on there. You know, like we're listening to Marlene Dietrich, and we'll be hearing Mabel Mercer in a minute. And there's also a record there of Music to Make Your Plants Grow, and there's
sure.
a record of, you know, Music
to
for
Freak
Lovers.
Your Friends and Break Your Lease.
Do you think it's the same people that are
my theory had been that, see, I don't believe that people can be put in slots or that people have a one-track mind. My theory is that if they're fans of mine, they very probably have some of the same tastes I do. It's been borne out by the number of records we've sold. So that's, I hope we continue to operate that way. I would like to do that. And Wade and I have, we very seldom have arguments over what we're going to release because we really have very much the same taste in music. Mm-hmm. For instance, to release a quad record of For Whom the Bell Tolls. That's an incredible score, and at Madman Murray's and record stores like that in New York, they were getting $100 for a recording of it. We found out it had been recorded in 4-track, so we went back and we recorded it, and we didn't re-record it, we just remixed it in quad and reissued it, thereby, I'm sure, causing Madman Murray lots of hassle because we don't sell them for $100 a copy. They're sold at regular price.
We're going to hear next a recording from a Mabel Mercer record that's entitled For Always, and we'll be hearing Ballad of the Sad Young Men, which has lyrics by Fran Lansman. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you know Mabel Mercer and the way this album has come
to be? Well, I met Mabel Mercer when I was recording for Decca, and she sang a song of mine, and I heard that she was doing it, and so I went to hear her one night, and she's never changed from the time I met her. This was 20 years ago. She sits in a chair, and without a microphone, she just sits and sings. Man plays a piano. Sinatra has said that he owes a great deal to her. Ella Fitzgerald has commented on how much she owes to Mabel Mercer. Sarah Vaughan, I mean, Nat King Cole. I mean, it's quite amazing. Tony Bennett. And I think anybody who appreciates lyrics sung well. This particular song is a favorite of mine. I'm so glad you picked it because I had the pleasure of making the first record of it ever made. It was done for a show called The Nervous Set, and I recorded on an old Decca album of mine called Very Warm. It was the first album I made for Decca. And shortly afterward, Mabel Mercer, who had been recording for Atlantic for some time, suddenly Decca talked her into coming over and doing one album with Ralph Burns, whom they had in a contract at the time, and then she went back to Atlantic. But this album, I just made a deal a few years ago to reissue it because I thought it was something that was sorely needed in the catalog. It's, to me, the definitive interpretation of the song. Now, the song's been sung by many, many people, and lots of people would love to call it their own. Roberta Flack sings it well. Lots of people do it well, but I don't think anyone approaches the tenderness yet the cynicism that Mabel Mercer is able to give it.
Okay, well, let's hear Mabel Mercer's recording of The Ballad of the Sad Young Man. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Rod McEwen, and we're talking about music that's recorded on his record label, Stanion Records.
Sing a song of sad young men, glasses full of rye. All the news is bad again. Kiss your dreams goodbye. All the sad young men sitting in the bars, knowing neon nights, missing all the stars. All the sad young men drifting through the town, drinking up the night, trying not to drown. All the sad young men singing in the cold, trying to forget that they're growing old. All the sad young men choking on their youth, trying to be brave, running from the truth. Autumn turns the leaves to gold, slowly dies the heart. Sad young men are growing old. That's the cruelest part. All the sad young men seek a certain smile, someone they can hold for a little while. Tired little girl does the best she can, trying to be gay for the sad young man. While a grimy moon watches from above, all the sad young men play at making love. Misbegotten moon, shine for sad young men. Let your gentle light guide them home tonight.
Mabel Mercer sang The Ballad of the Sad Young Man, and that's from an album called Mabel for Always. Mabel Mercer for Always. It's an album on Stanion Records. And my guest in the studio is Rod McEwen, who, in addition to the books that he writes and the concert tours that he goes on, also heads up Stanion Records. So we're talking to him today about his musical taste and some of the people who he's worked with during his performance and recording career. What did you listen to when you were real young? Do you recall?
Yeah, I do. I was very much influenced by Russian classical music, particularly Borodin, Steppes of Central Asia. I liked some Rachmaninoff, but found it a little overly romantic. Sounds odd coming from me, huh? People think I'm the world's most incurable romantic. But in classical music, and I liked Mussorgsky's Pictures and Exhibition, particularly the Ravel orchestration. as opposed to the piano version. I think I was, and then of course, as a teenager growing up, I was taken by Joe Stafford and Frankie Lane and Johnny Ray and people like that. And of course, along the way, you stumble onto Ella Fitzgerald. I used to have to go to the Primalon Ballroom in San Francisco, which was an all-black nightclub, to see Dinah Washington, and go to black Baptist churches in order to hear Mahalia Jackson, who was playing around Oakland at the time. And you'd put a buck in, and you'd go in, and she'd sing with an organ and a couple of guitars and a drum, and it was dynamite. And I've never really had influences other than the lyricists. Again, I mentioned Mercer and certainly Larry Hart and, of course, Noel Coward. Those are the kind of lyricists who there were never any extra words, never any unnecessary words. I'd sure like to get a hold of a lot of my old songs and get rid of some of the unnecessary words in them. It's a terrible feeling to know that, but I don't imagine Cole Porter heard many things of his that he would have rewritten, although it's hard for me to believe that Irving Berlin wrote something like All Alone by the Telephone, which is something I don't like very much, and also was capable of writing I Got Lost in His Arms and I Found My Way. That to me is quite a perceptive and unusual lyric just to be writing for Annie Get Your Gun. That, by the way, is the entire score for that is one of the great scores of all time.
Well, we're going to next hear George Burns singing Ain't Misbehavin', and this is kind of an oddity, I think. I've heard George Burns on record doing, you know, half-spoken, maybe half-sung vaudeville-type routines, but this is a pretty straight recording. This is George Burns as a singer.
We wanted George Burns in our Hollywood Canteen album because we had every other star you could think of that was, there entertaining the troops when they would pass through Los Angeles and Long Beach on their way to the Pacific during the Second World War. In Great Britain, they had Rainbow Corner, which was the same kind of thing as Hollywood Canteen. In New York City, they had the Stage Door Canteen. And I thought it would be kind of fun to do something very current. And this was just 3 or 4 years ago. And George had cut an album for Buddha Records. And I'd heard the album, and the album had not sold that well, but I just thought it was a dynamite album. And, you know, usually you hear him singing the Red Rose Rag and things like that. And I thought this was really just lovely. The orchestration is nice. No one could possibly make an apology for this record. And I happen to think George Burns sings very well. He's like Fred Astaire. He's not as good a singer as Fred Astaire, but then nobody is. But with little or no vocal equipment, he puts the message across.
So this was recorded recently in the 1970s?
Yeah, very recently, in the 60s.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is George Burns singing Ain't Misbehavin'.
Though it's a fickle age, with flirting all the rage, here is one bird with self-control, happy inside my cage. I know who I love best, thumbs down for all the rest. My love was given heart and soul, so it can stand the test. Now in the dark, all by myself. Now in the walkway, I'm happy on the shelf, babe. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. I know for certain you're the one I love. I'm through with flirting, baby. It's just you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Jackie Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere. What do I care? kisses I weren't waiting for. Believe me, believe me, pretty baby, I don't go out late, don't care to go. I'm home about it, just me and my radio. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Jackie Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? For your kisses I was waiting for, believe me. Buddle-dee-doodle-dee-doodle-dee-doo-doo, I don't stay out late, don't care to go. Home about it, just me and my radio. Ain't misbehaving, I'm saving. I'm saving, yes, I'm saving. Ooh, I'm saving all my love for you.
George Burns, as recorded in the 1970s, singing Ain't Misbehavin', and featured on an album called A Salute to the Hollywood Canteen, which features many performers who performed for the troops during the Second World War. If you're just joining us, my guest in the studio is Rod McEwen, who you probably know through his own records and through his books, but he's also the director of a record company called Stanion Records, and we've been listening to music that's featured on there, including the George Burns selection that we just heard. One of the things that you're doing with some of the records that you're releasing is kind of salvaging things that are hidden away in vaults of record companies and stuff. What happens if one of your records goes out of print? I mean, you've got a relatively small catalog. It's something that, you know, you could probably maintain print. But, you know, say one of your records were going to go out of print. What kind of what would happen to the artist? Yeah.
What I did was this. You mean if one of the records from the label or one of my own personal records?
One of the records from the label.
If it were going to go out of print on the on Stanion, it would mean that it had sold very well and that we would keep it going. Otherwise, if it had taken, or it might mean that it took a long, long time for it to sell, then we would be faced with a decision as to whether or not to retire the album for a while and spend the money that we would ordinarily spend on a repressing to launch yet another record, because you can only put out so many and give them so much attention. Most likely what we would do is we would probably take something else by the same artist. But if it was something that went out of print in a hurry, it would mean that it was something that was successful and it was making money for us, making money for the artist, and was helping the record company put out the lost losers, if you will. You know, the albums that perhaps don't have that wide an audience, but if they're given time, could develop an audience, I think. I think anything that is of quality, if it's given time, whether it's an Ames chair or a building by Frank Lloyd Wright, if it's given time, it will it'll develop an audience. It'll develop a place, a niche of its own.
Well, we've been listening to other people who are featured on your label. We're going to next listen to something of your own. And this comes from a series that you've been working on for television called The Unknown War. No, it doesn't. My mistake. Well, we're going to be hearing something called Toward the Unknown, and why don't you tell us where it's from?
It does come from The Unknown
War. Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, the music is from The Unknown War, and there are about seven or eight different lyrics throughout the picture to the same music. This particular lyric is not used in the film, and there is yet another revision and yet another revision of the lyric. This album was done when the series was first being produced. I put a lyric to the music because so many artists wanted to record the song, and so it was kind of a temporary lyric, and I'm not all that satisfied with it, but I'm very satisfied with the show and very satisfied with my contribution to the show. I've written marches and waltzes and a complete piano concerto for the series. It's about the war on the Eastern Front. It's 20 hours of primetime television, sold independently. I don't know where it's playing here in Philadelphia, but it's about to play, I think, right after the first of the year. And it's bought for two runs by whichever station buys it, someplace at CBS, someplace NBC. I'm thrilled because in many places it's outrating Laverne and Shirley and Happy Times and things like that, which to me points to good television. A lot of love and a lot of hard work went into this series. There was a very fine Soviet team working on it, and Americans such as Harrison Salisbury, Burt Lancaster's narrator. I did the music. I did a lot of research on the scripts. Professor John Lord of Harvard University wrote the final script. So it comes with pretty good credentials, and it deals with that whole element of the war that none of us really know that much about. Anyway, this is the music that is the main title theme, and the lyric on this particular record exists just for me to sing.
Okay, well, let's hear Rod McEwen singing one of his own.
Hello, goodbye, with never a why, and so we're left alone. It seems to me we're all meant to be heading toward the unknown. A touch, a smile, and after a while, we think perhaps we've grown. It's partly illusion, mostly delusion, leading toward the unknown. And who's to say what matters? The world around us is falling to tatters. Not to say yes, they say the time has shown. But love, like life, is only a dream leading toward the unknown. But I believe that what we receive is only ours alone. And part of the living is made up of giving, even toward the unknown. And who's to say what matters? The world around us has fallen to tatters. I'm not afraid of games that are played that lead us toward the unknown.
That was Toward the Unknown. It was written by Rod McEwen, who is my guest, who also sung the lyric in that recording. And it was written for a television series called The Unknown War that was co-produced by Russian television, I believe.
No, not a Russian documentary. We heard about a lot of films that were in the Kremlin, vaults that no one had ever seen. Captured Nazi footage, Russian films that were taken during the Second World War. And, you know, in America, when we could see submarines off the coast of San Francisco, or at least they said that, and we were, you know, Pearl Harbor was kind of in the backyard, and the biggest battles were fought in the Pacific. Even though we did have men in Europe, it was much later on in the war. They first went to the Pacific. And because of that, what happened on the Eastern Front is not all that well known. And it took a long, long time for Churchill and Roosevelt to open up a second front. And Churchill had good reason to dislike Stalin, but nevertheless, we were allies at the time. And his thinking, as we see now from the Whitehall memos, influenced Roosevelt a great deal. And so the Second Front wasn't really opened in time.
Well, Rod McEwen, you certainly are in a lot of places now, on television, in performance. You have a new book out. There's your record label. I guess it would be safe to say that you're satisfied with with the way your life has been going?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I believe that my life is probably just starting. I have a lot of things I want to do and I'm going to do. And in fact, Stallion Records, I got into it, as I said, out of frustration. I'm at the point where I really want to, from the day-to-day handling of it, to pass from the hands of Wade, who is a very capable president and producer for the company, and from my hands into somebody else's, where we can have a sort of a supervisory area, because there are so many things that both of us as individuals want to do, and he also manages me, so that I'm doing a lot of other things, more film scores, more classical music, more ballets, a lot of commissions from American orchestras and orchestras in Great Britain. I'm going to direct a film very shortly. There are a lot of things I want to do, and some things I don't even know about yet. I just want to be of use, of service, and I think that's very important. My country's given a lot to me, and I really feel like it's time I gave more back.
Well, listen, thank you for being here this afternoon. We're out of time now. I want to thank you for joining us on Fresh Air.
Pleasure, and it's fresh air indeed to hear these old recordings played, and I have to almost apologize for Toward the Unknown, because in a way, it was nice of you to play it because I'm here, but in a way it really doesn't belong with all these magnificent recordings by people like Dietrich and the likes of Greta Keller and George Burns and something you're about to play.
Well, we're about to close the show with a piece by Duke Ellington, but first I'd like to thank my guest, Rod McEwen, again for his appearance here this afternoon on Fresh Air. The music we've heard during the past hour is recorded on Rod McEwen's record label called Stallion Records.